Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome once again to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm your host, Steve LeBeau, and we have a repeat guest, Sam Imbo. I should say Professor Sam Imbo, PhD in philosophy. And he's the, are you still the chairman?
I am the chair of the department, yes. And Steve, thank you very much for the welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, chair of the department at Hamline University in St. Paul.
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, so how you been doing, Sam?
I've been doing very well. The year seems to go very quickly.
Well, that's always good and bad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Of course.
You get into a routine doing some things, and then you have a list of things to do. Sometimes you accomplish it, sometimes you don't.
Well, I know your specialty is political philosophy, and do you pay attention to actual politics as well? Do you watch CNN and see what's going on in with all the political parties?
I try to pay attention, but it's getting more and more difficult to do. I am much more interested in the political theory, not in the actual politics, but sometimes the ideas play out in real life. And so I pay attention to that extent.
Well, I mean, have you ever seen such, they call it echo chambers, where the Republicans and Democrats are so vividly separated? Have you seen anything like that before?
That seems to be a new phenomenon, because people are listening to only those people who agree with them. And so you'll read and talk to people who agree with the same things that you believe in, and you never hear anything that is different. So when you hear a different opinion, it's shocking, it's surprising, and you wonder, where did that come from? But it's because we don't pay attention to people who are different. I think we should do more of that.
Well, it's easier than ever to not pay attention to other viewpoints, because you can find the viewpoint you want, because we have so many different television programs and news programs. You can go to the liberal one, MSNBC. You can go to the conservative one on Fox. And then somewhere in the middle is CNN, I believe, although they tend to be liberal because they keep trying to focus on the facts.
Well, you can find any medium that suits your preconceived ideas. And so part of what happens is people find something that agrees with their political idea, and that is all they listen to. And maybe these news media are set up just that way. This is not by accident. They have figured out this is the demographic we want, and this is what they need to hear, and so we'll give it to them. So partly what is happening here is not by accident, and I think that is the saddest part of all this.
It's a diabolical scheme.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but somebody's planning all this. It is not happening by accident.
So by scheme, I mean it's deliberate.
Yes, yes.
Because people are benefiting from it.
Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made. You get people angry, you get people riled up, you get them to your point of view, and then you can have commercials that cater to them. You can sell things, and you can fundraise this way. So there's money to be made in this deal.
Well, it's kind of ironic, because I remember during the primary 4 years ago that CNN would often do the entire rallies of Donald Trump. And so because Donald Trump attracted a big audience.
Yes.
And so CNN wanted that audience, so they kept running his entire rallies. and that helped them get elected. And then they would say, how did this guy ever get elected?
Yeah, so part of what is happening here is the TV stations want viewers, and you figured out what you need to get eyeballs. And so campaign rally gets people interested, and the president in particular has quite a following. So people will listen to what he has to say. I don't know that much news was being made, but a whole lot of interest was focused that way. And in the meantime, we're not focused where we should actually be.
Right. Where should we focus?
On things that are important, on things that we could learn something about. So spectacle is one thing, but we should be focused on what are the values that we hold to be similar? What are the things we care about? If we're not talking about those things, we're simply interested in things which are not going to last very long. So I think we are wrongly focused most of the time.
Well, I know you deal in philosophy and the ideologies, the more abstract perspective, but if you were to step in and try to change things to get people to talk together more, what would you do?
Well, we focus on, so what is the American project about? What are we trying to do? We're trying to create a country in which everybody is welcome. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter where you're from. So if that is the important thing, how do we get to do that? And you don't get to do that by dividing people up or by not listening to people who are different. You want to hear from people who are different. And so part of what we need to ask ourselves is, why are we doing this? The country is being formed in a way that may not be very helpful for us in the future. So we want to focus on that. We want to focus on things about truth and falsity. When somebody says something, why did they say that? What is the evidence for it? More and more, it's like people will just say things because they make some people angry. And there's no evidence that is being given. And so I'm thinking, if I had any more power than I do, I would get people to focus on what is the more important thing? Truth, beauty, justice. Those are the kinds of things philosophers are interested in.
But I think you're right. Truth seems to have lost its value because, honesty is dedication to truth. And if people deliberately are dishonest, but then usually there's peer pressure to kind of keep people in place, that a dishonest person gets caught and shamed and doesn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But today it seems like, well, that's the way you do business. You lie and cheat, and then if you win, that's all that matters. It's not if you play by the rules, it's if you win.
We were talking a little bit earlier about none of this is happening by accident. So there are people who have figured out that truth may not be really that important. What is important is winning, getting your way. And philosophers long ago discovered that winning is not everything. It depends on how one wins. Something might be successful in the short term, but what we really want is success in the long term. And so truth is always truth, whether you accept it or not. We might be mistaken for a while, but eventually we get to see what the truth is because it prevails. What has happened in this country is a very clear movement towards just saying things so that people will get on your side, never caring whether it is true or not. And I think that is one of the saddest things about the past few years.
And then there's this, as you say, a secondary industry in the media. And there are even books put out that I've read that change the interpretation of history. That really bothers me. But then if a person listens to the right channel and reads those books and only talks to people that believe the same way, how can they break out of that echo chamber? How can they? It's like Plato's cave, right? They're all looking at the same shadows.
Yep.
How can you convince them that there's better shadows or even go outside and look at the real thing?
So part of what has happened is if we cannot agree on what is truth, then anything I say works for me and anything you say works for you. So we just have to find out who has many people on their side. But truth has rarely been about how many people believe in it. Some of the most profound truths were not seen by the majority of people for the longest time. I've always said that there was a time that everybody thought the world was flat, and the majority thought this. They were mistaken about it. But eventually, it becomes clear that that was not the position to hold. Now, if it is pointed out to you that the world is not flat, the right response is to be ashamed of having held on to this untruth for the longest time and to make sure that you don't do this again. But that takes an amount of self-awareness. It takes an amount of shame. But if you have lost self-awareness, if you have lost a sense of shame, it is very difficult to get people to see that they're saying untrue things. Now, the scary thing is maybe they're saying untrue things knowing full well what they're doing. And that is a much more scary proposition because they're not mistaken about it. They know it is false, but they're saying it anyways because it gets them what they want to do. I hope that we move away from that, that truth becomes, again, a matter that we care about. If somebody says something, let's ask for the evidence. And asking for evidence does not mean we dislike the person who is saying these things. We're simply wanting to find out, what is the basis for your claim? How can we make sure that it is true, independent of what you say about it? So we want to take your word for it, but is there any other way that corroborates what you're saying?
Does philosophy have any role for helping solve these problems?
Philosophers have always cared about statements being made and reasons being given for those statements. So if you look at the very old philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the whole Western tradition, the Eastern tradition, the African tradition, people were caring about why do we say what we are saying? What is the reason I have for saying what I do? We have a long tradition of that. And so philosophers might actually help us think about justifying what we say. And if you find that you have no justification, as Socrates said, that is the surest way that you should stop believing what you believe in, because you have no reason to believe it. Simply the fact that you believe something does not mean you should. It means that you should have reasons for why you believe what you do.
So if we could inject some reasonableness or rationality into the whole process, that would help.
That would help. It is something we all need to work at. It doesn't come naturally to any of us. We have to train ourselves to think clearly, to stay with an idea, to even ideas that are uncomfortable. We have to think about, why do I make this claim? What is the evidence for it? What happens if I find I am mistaken? And a lot of the times we are mistaken not because we are bad people. It is simply because you are working with bad information. And if you find out what the right thing to do is, the responsible thing is to abandon the idea that does not work and to move on to the idea that is newly discovered. This is how progress happens. We don't hold on to things which no longer work. We might have the power to convince people to believe what we do, but we're not always going to have that power. So what you have to assume is that truth is going to be much more powerful than the powerful people amongst us who want to force us to believe what they now believe.
So truth will win out, but it might take a while.
It might take a while, and sometimes it's not clear how this is going to work out, but you have to be optimistic about truth is going to find a way if enough of us persevere, if enough of us keep saying that truth matters. Words do have meanings. The kinds of people that we are creatures of habit. We form good habits or bad habits. We don't want to go too far down the way of forming bad habits. We ought to reform ourselves and become better people. It is the new year after all.
This is a
good opportunity to begin a new self-formation.
Learn how to reason more clearly and accurately. I've always thought it would be great if the philosophy departments would put together a squad of students that would analyze political discourse, opinions, and speeches in terms of looking for logical fallacies and finding whether they're actually using good reason in all these political presentations.
That might be a good thing to do, but I think we find ourselves in a very difficult moment in our culture when there's so much untruth. These students or people who are interested in truth would be fully occupied just keeping track
too much of work.
The statements made by politicians on a day-to-day basis.
Well, there's two things. There's the facts, and we do have all kinds of fact-checking organizations around that will, immediately after a speech on CNN or elsewhere, they'll have their fact checked. Well, they said this, that's not true, this is not true. But they don't talk about the reasoning, whether these things support their conclusions.
Yeah. The difficulty for us is, of course, that facts are kind of constructed within contexts. So facts are not freestanding.
So facts are not facts.
If we begin arguing about facts, this is an important thing. We have to go back and say, do we have an agreement about that truth matters? Falsity is something to be avoided. Do we at least agree on that? And then facts begin to make sense. Not anything that people say is going to be a fact, but people will claim anything they say to be a fact. So we're not in agreement about what facts are. When people who want to give us their lies as facts say that they're giving us facts, what they're really saying is that what you call fact is not what I call fact. And so part of what we need to do is kind of come to an agreement about, so what are the things that we really know to be true? If somebody makes a statement, we can check it out in various ways. And so if I say that it is raining outside, one of the things we could do is figure out, well, somebody take a look outside, look at the weather forecast. Is it actually raining? If somebody makes a claim about the weather is projected to be bad in this state at this time, we can check the meteorological departments and see, is that what they're claiming? So as I remember, one of the controversies of last year was about a weather forecast that the president took a position on.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that the weather services had a completely different idea of what was happening. And I would go much more with people who have the facts on their side than people who simply claim to know things.
Yeah, but in that particular instance in which President Trump used a Sharpie to extend the range of possible hurricane damage, he doubled down and they made the Weather Service punish the people that opposed the president. It's as if you walk in dripping wet and they say, well, it must be raining. No, it wasn't raining. They'll deny even the facts before your eyes.
Well, what happens there is clearly the president has powers of all kinds. And one of the powers is to do as they wish. They may not always be right, but in the case of the weather, I think everybody who looks at this realizes the president was wrong. He should have admitted that he was wrong, but refused to do so. So what it says to us is we are dealing here with a case in which agreement is not to be reached on was the weather service right or wrong. And people who have spent their time looking at the weather, I would go with them over somebody who does not have that skill. And if the Sharpie was done by somebody in the White House, you want to find out, so exactly who was it?
Saying it was the president.
Are there people who are going around the White House marking up weather forecasts with Sharpies? Well, we should find them and see what they have to say for themselves. So in this case, it is very clear that people who have political power may do certain things, but that does not equate with truth.
Now, do you talk about these practical incidents in your classrooms?
Not much, only to the extent that these things are relevant. But it gets political very quickly. If you say any such thing, people will see this as either a dislike of or disagreement with people who are holding these views. It's nothing of that sort. It's simply a statement is being made. The weather forecast says this. Well, the weather forecast either says it or does not. We are either right about it or not. And if you are interested in that, you ask people who know about those things. And the people who know about those things then will tell you, given their experience and their expertise, here's what they say. And I would trust that much more than somebody who does not have the expertise.
Mm. Well, I think we have a problem with agreeing on what reality is. you're listening to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. Our special guest is Professor Sam Imbo, the chair of the philosophy department at Hamline University in St. Paul. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And welcome back to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. Steve LeBeau here with Sam Imbo. Professor Imbo, I'm wondering, the students that come into your classes at Hamline University, do they seem to have good basic understanding of the American political process when they walk in? Are the schools doing a good job training them in public affairs?
Well, they have some understanding of their reality up to that point. If you take
their reality.
up to that point, they have gone through elementary school, high school, they're now in college. So they have gone through some things. It is not always evidence of deep knowledge of America's history or a number of the things that they should know. So I don't know if the students are to blame or the systems are to blame, but I try to find out, so what books have you read? What authors do you talk about in high school? And it turns out high school is very busy with other things. So that
so they haven't read any of the books.
There are important books which have not crossed their paths. And what so we try to work on filling in those gaps.
What would be an important book that high schoolers ought to read?
Well, I keep thinking that if you are interested in American history, you should have read some slave narrative, for example. There are many of these that were written during the period right after slavery by escaped slaves. So if you have never heard of Frederick Douglass, for example, one or two. If you have never heard of Harriet Jacobs, you should have. If you have never heard of Booker T. Washington, you should have. There were eras of American civil rights. So you might have heard names of people like Marcus Garvey, and W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, I find that many students will have heard those names in passing during February, Black History Month.
Oh, sure.
But will not have read anything written by those people. So it seems to me like a gap in their knowledge.
So you have to do a lot of catching up.
So I put some of those books on the reading list. We are a philosophy department, and we see ourselves as interested in truth for all time and in truth as it plays out in particular places. So if you are studying philosophy in America, one should be able to say about things about right things or wrong things that have happened in our context as a way of knowing what we're dealing with and how to move forward.
So I've been interested in finding out to the extent that there's an interface between the philosophical knowledge of political science and actual politics. And it seems like there's not much of an interface.
There should be. All political ideas get played out in very real places. So there are some theorists who are not interested in actual political power. They're simply interested in playing around with ideas. And people who hold political office then have to actually deal in the real world with some idea that they have. They're going to have to borrow from various places. So our politicians, whether they know it or not, are borrowing from or using ideas from political theorists. And so part of what I am always interested in is to have our students say something about, do you know about Thomas Hobbes? Do you know about John Locke? Do you know about Rousseau? Do you know about Machiavelli? Now, these ideas may not come out of our politicians' mouths, but they're reaching back into things that have come to us from that tradition.
Well, Machiavelli seems to echo a lot in our current day because there's a strong rise in authoritarianism, not simply here in America, but around the world.
Yeah, Machiavelli saw himself as giving advice to a politician who needed to hold on to power. And so what he was interested in was not acting ethically or morally, because he said people who do that do not tend to stay in power very long.
Right.
What you want to do is be successful in holding on to office. And you might need to do evil things. You might need to do them quickly. You might need to do them effectively. And so Machiavelli is a fairly odd person in terms of political philosophy. But he gets used much more and more these days, because people are all about winning and getting the votes on your side, whether by the right way or not. And Machiavelli, to me, is a cautionary tale about how much we lose when we lose sight of the place of ethics in political discourse.
But that brings back to the beginning of our conversation, in which it doesn't matter what you do as long as you win. That's Machiavellian, right?
Yeah, there are people who think this, and so it doesn't matter what you do. I think the best sense of American politics is by those people who felt, yeah, we want to win, but we want to do the right thing as well. So people who marry ethics and politics tend to be much more successful leaders. You can command much more of a following that way. You can get people to actually agree with you. If you're simply overpowering people, getting them to do things because you can, they will resent it. People will not want to follow you of their own accord. So doing the right thing has its own benefits. You may not always win, but I think it is the much more sustainable way of moving forward.
Nice guys finish last.
Well, sadly.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had a political psychologist on the podcast here, and he was saying that, and I think it's pretty true in psychology in general, and especially in advertising as far as applied psychology, is people do not run their lives rationally. They run their lives through their emotions and their desires, and that what seems to be happening is people are politicians, especially Donald Trump, but others, his predecessors as well, try to appeal to fear and other emotions to motivate followers rather than strong rational arguments.
This is true. I think sadly that's what you have said is very true. Fear is a big motivator, and Machiavelli, if we go back to him, said, if you could control one thing, do you want to control whether people love you or whether they fear you? Well, it is very hard to control whether people love you or not. It's much easier to control whether they fear you. And so fear is a much more effective thing as a political tool. I think we'll agree that it is not the best tool to use. It might work for now.
Well, that's it. If it works.
It works for now. We want something that works for a long time. The reason for the American project is not something that will work today or next year or 10 years from now. But how can we leave a better world for people who are coming later? It's not by motivating people through fear. There are better ways of doing this. So fear may work for now. It may work for the short term. It is not a long-term strategy.
Once again, what can we do about this?
Well, get people to see that the person who is making you afraid has chosen how to motivate people. What they're thinking is that fear is what will get you to vote for me. It tells us something about the moment we are in. It tells us something about the leaders we now have. What do they go to as a strategy? If fear is all they have to fall back on, clearly they don't have ideas which they value. I would much rather focus on ideas that we could share together, build a much more stronger economy on, have economic programs, educational programs built on ideas that are longstanding. And fear is not one of those. It is a fairly short-term strategy. And I think if we find ourselves falling back on that, the politicians who use it might seem to be effective for now. It is not people who are going to be looked upon favorably by history.
I'm working on a book now with a psychologist, and it involves the autonomic nervous system.
Uh-huh.
the human body. And one of the facts that come out is that if a person is fearful, their amygdala is activated, and they're kind of their ancient part of their brain, and what it does is it kind of short circuits the prefrontal cortex, is our where our rationality comes from. So if a person is engaged in fear, you can't talk to them rationally. It's, that part doesn't work.
That's true, and I think what political advertisements rely on is motivating that fear center. Have people be afraid.
Cutting out the reason.
Cutting out the reason. And so commercials for politicians are not always about the reasons that they're doing the things that they are. They want you to be afraid of what the other person will bring. The other people are always evil and bad for America and terrible. They're socialists, they're communists. So this does not address any of the arguments the other side is making. It simply calls them names. And if you're afraid of communists, well, you certainly don't want any communists in your midst. It doesn't address the idea that we should be discussing. What is so bad about this idea? Give us the reason that you have. And if a politician cannot do that, it says to you that they're bankrupt in terms of ideas.
If you're reasonable.
If you are reasonable, yes. And that, to me, is the stronger place to begin with. Fear is maybe a motivating factor for the short term. It should not be what a reasonable politician falls on.
Right. Well, reasonable politician, that's one of your possible oxymorons. Well, you're from Kenya.
Yep.
Now, how does politics work there? Is there similarities or differences?
Well, sad to say, American politics is beginning to look more and more like Kenyan politics.
Oh, really?
So the third world is controlled by people who are in power because not because they are reasonable or they are smart. It is because they are powerful and they get things done because they can overpower everybody else. I hate to see America become a version of that. I always thought of America as a place in which people had the freedom to discuss ideas, and the ideas rose to the fore. And if it was a bad idea, it became clear to us this was a bad idea, and we did not follow it. We got people to do things because we motivated them in the right ways possible. That is not what happened in the third world, and Kenyan politics has been the politics of the strong person for the longest time. You would hate to see this happening in parts of the industrialized world, and America in particular.
Boy, sometime in the last year, I had two immigrants on the podcast, and they were kind of saying about kind of the unfairness going on in America toward immigrants. And then I asked them, well, what's good about America as opposed to your home countries? One woman was from Liberia, and the other woman was from Ecuador. And they said the big difference between America and their home countries is their home countries were so corrupt that America, even though we might see signs of corruptness, they say it's much worse in their home countries, that you couldn't trust anybody in any government to get anything done.
Yep, so corruption is one of those features of less developed countries. And one would hate to see it in America as well. And so I would agree with those immigrants that the real difference between America and other places was our corruption was not to the extent that it was in other places. We should keep it that way. There has always been corruption. We hope that people who are corrupt, we can point this out and bring them to justice. Part of what makes America better than other places is when you are corrupt, we can find ways of showing that this is the case and then having people pay for the corrupt actions that they did. It is a very scary thing when corrupt people add to that political power, and so they can get away with anything that they have done. The difference between the United States and other places was people did not get away with things. Well, sometimes they did, but for the most part, the legal justice system works. We hope that it works even better than it works in third world countries. it's a very sad state of affairs when we are comparing ourselves to third world places.
Well, that's kind of the story. Corruption is one of the elements in the whole impeachment trial now, is that President Trump said he was trying to solve corruption in Ukraine, when it sounds more like corruption was being perpetrated using Ukraine as an excuse. Well, what do you think of the whole impeachment scenario right now?
Well, the issue is to look at the claims being made and the reasons being offered for them. So I take it that one of the claims is the president is interested in corruption. If that is the claim that is being made, let's see some evidence for that. What is the evidence for this interest in corruption? And I think you'll be familiar with the idea that people have been asking for the president's tax returns for many years. If you're interested in corruption, let's see how your personal finances have been before you ran for office and after you ran for office. We have not been able to see those. And so clearly this interest in corruption must be newly found. But if you're interested in corruption in Europe, well, you had many opportunities to say this in the various calls that the president made to the president of Ukraine. There were opportunities to bring up corruption. The president did not do that. And so a claim is being made and very little evidence is being offered for it. And I think that is where we should be. Where is the evidence for the claims being made?
But it seems like the system, the way it's working now, going to the Senate, well, the Senate is all Republicans, and once again, it's kind of a power thing. They're also driven by fear, fear of losing their seats. So they don't want to vote against Trump because then they might lose their jobs.
Yeah, and it is yet another similarity to the third world when fear controls what you do. So if somebody has made you so afraid of them that you'll not call out the things they're doing, they've taken away your freedom effectively. And that is what America was never supposed to be. So if you are so afraid of somebody that you cannot say they're doing the wrong things, ask yourself what has happened to your freedom and liberty. And is that one of the things that you value? How do you get it back? Now, a trial in the Senate would have to be a trial like any other trial that we know. Who are the witnesses? How do we treat the witnesses? You are aware that during the impeachment, there are a whole lot of people who have direct information about what happened, who have been prevented from speaking publicly about it. Will they be called to speak about these things now? And if not, why not? So one would have to ask, what kind of trial is being arranged for the president or for taking care of the impeachment business? Is it going to be a fair trial or not? And I think anybody who thinks about these things must ask about, do we have all the information that we need? And if not, why don't we do that before we make any judgments?
It seems like, I'm speaking as an independent, it seems like not everyone wants to see the truth.
Well, this is a sad thing for them and for the country. If you're not interested in the truth, at least say that. I am not interested in the truth. And then clearly, if one was to say that, this is wrong. Why are you not interested in the truth? Is it because you're afraid? What are you afraid of? And I think those are the questions that we need to be asking. We find ourselves unable to say things because the consequences are going to be so terrible. The consequences to people who say something is wrong when it is actually wrong, we should not be punishing people for saying something is wrong if they see it that way. The powerful people should not have that power.
Well, once again, back to that topic of power. It seems to be dominating everything else. We're listening here with Sam Imbo, a professor of philosophy and the chair of the department at Hamline University, talking. He's involved in political science.
Well, I'm not involved in political science. I'm interested in political ideas.
Political philosophy, okay, pardon me. Yeah. So, yeah, there's no science at all having anything to do with it.
I have colleagues who do political science, and they do something slightly different.
Okay. Okay, we'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back. Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau with Professor Sam Imbo, PhD in political philosophy. I'm sorry, I never want science to override philosophy. not a political scientist, political philosopher.
I just don't want to make claims to be doing things I'm not actually doing.
No, because that would run counter to your whole dedication toward truth. So let's see. Last year you had an interesting guest speaker to give a lecture at Hamline, Charles Mills.
That's right. That's
and he's
right.
From where, Columbia?
He's at... New York University.
New York University.
Yeah, grad center at NYU.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's great. And he had a very interesting view of kind of analyzing the heredity of political philosophy as having hidden presuppositions. Maybe you should explain this. Hidden presuppositions that kind of supported racism and slavery.
Yeah. Charles Mills has this idea that political philosophy is important. It is important to know the ideas from which we are working. And he has spoken widely about this and written about it, that the formative ideas of American political arrangements was already biased. And it is biased in racial terms in a way that is not clear to many people. So what we take to be neutral statements are already loaded in a way that needs to be unpacked. And so if we simply looked at our foundational documents, it's hard to make sense of them if you ignore the fact that they were written at a very particular moment in history by very particular people for very particular purposes. So the founding fathers had a stake in what was happening. They were creating a new experiment. But in coming together to make these ideas, what they kind of elided over was the whole place of race in the scheme of things that they were doing. And so Charles Mills is making the case that prior to the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution of the United States, there is kind of a racial contract that has already happened that undergirds all the documents that we then bring forward. If we ignore that, we're not going to be able to solve any of the problems that come up much later. So it's not an indictment of America as a country. He's simply saying that in order to solve the problems that we have, we need to really understand how we got to be where we are. And race has always been central and not as a side issue of what we're doing.
Well, philosophy asks people to reflect on their presuppositions. And this is a case of that.
It is a case.
What were they believing when they formed the country?
Well, they were believing that they wanted something different from what England was. So this was going to be a whole new arrangement. But in practical terms, the people who were making these discussions were some of them slave owners, and they were quite aware of that, and they were aware of the lack of equality between white and black and Native American at the time. And so in bringing about this new place, they had to deal with the very real realities of not equality from the get-go. So they wrote the documents in a way that made possible for equality to come in later, even though they talked about equality in the documents that they were putting forward.
Well, it's kind of like our discussion today. You're talking about the ideas, the philosophical ideas, and I'm trying to see how they interface with reality. And there's always this gap between the ideas and the reality. And the same thing in the Declaration of Independence: all men are created equal, while except for women and slaves and Native Americans.
Yeah. So they talk about equality, but it is equality of those at the table. And I think Charles Mills' point was, think about those people who are not at the table and how equal they might have been in these foundational documents. Now, part of the beauty of America is that we make it possible for people who come in later to be part of the project as well. The discussion is always going to be, can they truly be equal partners in what is happening? And I think American political discourse has always been about getting everybody to be on the same playing field, whether that is possible or not. There have been African Americans who thought the project was impossible from the very start. There are those who thought the project was flawed but had hope. And so I mentioned Frederick Douglass before. Douglass was of the idea that even though terrible things had happened, he was a product of slavery, yet he could see himself as an equal of those people who had previously enslaved him. It was possible to see yourself in terms of equality, even though people have not always practiced that. So there are two strands in American politics. Those who are hopeful about the possibility of redemption, and those who gave up hope that nothing is going to work, let's not bother with the experiment. I tend to be on the optimistic side.
Oh, good.
I tend to be very optimistic about this. I think there's hope.
Well, in order to be optimistic, then you must believe in progress and change.
Yes, I do. I do. There has been progress and change. I think nobody can deny that. If you think about the various amendments to the U.S. Constitution, even though equality was not a thing in the beginning, but after the Civil War, well, there are amendments about equal protections under the law. So equality comes in. The right of women to vote is agreed upon much later, in 1920. So progress has been made. We are not where we used to be in the 1700s. Much more progress can still be made. So when I look around, my students, my colleagues, people who are fighting for rights now are saying exactly the same things that people who are fighting for rights in the 1700s were saying. We are not part of this story yet. We want to be part of that story as well. So when I look at GLBTQ folk now, what they're saying is we still have struggles ahead of us, and some of the things that were said by people who went ahead might be useful for us in this struggle.
So there's more amendments to be written.
There's more amendments to be written, but as we talked about earlier, it's harder and harder to do that now. If you think about it, takes a whole lot of states to agree on an amendment before it becomes an amendment. We are nowhere close to getting the right number of states to agree on any change that we want to make to the Constitution.
Well, we can't get people from different parties to agree on almost anything.
Yeah.
So even what reality is or climate change, things that scientists agree on.
So, yeah, it's the discussion is just much, much harder in terms of where are we and where should we be going. We are going to have to talk much more strongly, much more clearly about what is our future.
Well, you're a philosopher, and one of the nice things about philosophy is that when you're thinking in the realm of ideas, you're beyond space and time, right? It's kind of an escape on one hand, because you're not dealing with the down on the earth issues. You know, nobody's hitting you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Do you imagine what an ideal place would look like?
Well, I have this luxury of playing with ideas, discussing them with students. Now, I am not a politician in the sense of wanting particular things done. So when I'm talking with my students about truth and falsity and things that should not be, it's not that I want to convince them one way or another. It is important for us not to believe the wrong things. It is important for us to think about ideas which are helpful. It is important for us to avoid ideas that have not worked in the past. So long as we can do that, this is what the ideal ought to be. So for me, the ideal world would be one in which we have more opportunities to think about ideas and are not kind of crushed out by the concerns of the moment. Our world has become so busy. Things are always beeping, and our attention is being called in this direction or that direction.
I know, I just got beeped a minute ago.
Well, this is a sad thing about modern life. We should slow it down.
So we need more philosophy cafes.
We need more philosophy cafes. We need more thoughtful people in whatever area. So one does not need to be a philosophy major to think philosophical ideas. Philosophy plays out in biology, in physics, in chemistry, in political science. Whatever it is that you're doing, ask yourself, could I do this better? How do I work with people who are doing the same things that I have? When I disagree with other people in my field, what is the respectful way to do that? So we're not picking fights with people because we dislike them. We're simply talking about what would be a better way for us to move forward.
Well, in philosophy, ideally, it's a place where people can exchange ideas and then the good ideas can win out. Mm-hmm. What we don't see very clearly now in our actual political environment. But even in philosophy, I know what I've seen is there's a lot of intolerance for other viewpoints, and they say, well, that's not philosophy. I mean, well, here, you've written books about African philosophy,
yep.
And I bet there are a lot of American and European philosophers that say, no, that's not philosophy.
That's true. So philosophers do not have a clear sight all the time about what the right things to do are. Philosophers disagree amongst themselves, and there are some people who are very bad at arguing or very bad at figuring out what is important. And the more we talk with them, the more we realize we disagree on what is important and what is not. So you're quite right. Within my own field, philosophy, Africana philosophy is not usually been seen very positively. There has been a lot of movement. We're not now where we were many years back. But in any case, there's much more acceptance that non-Western philosophy has something important to say. Indian philosophy has something important to say. Feminist philosophy has something important to say. Now, there are philosophers who don't agree with any of those statements. They just happen to be wrong about it. We could talk about philosophers who are progressive and those who are not. The field of philosophy tends to be very, very conservative in the sense that things that have worked in the past is what we should be going for now.
Make philosophy great again.
What we ought to be doing is expanding philosophy and bringing in new ideas. This is what feminists are doing, African philosophers, Indian philosophy. Non-Western philosophy as a whole is trying to say that the story of philosophy you have been telling so far needs to be complicated a whole lot more.
Well, historically, philosophy began in parts of the world where there was a lot of commercial trading going on.
Yep.
And when you have commercial exchange of products, you also have exchange of ideas. And so the Greeks, they were very active traders around the Mediterranean. And so they had ideas from Egypt and I believe ideas from India, some say.
Yeah.
So that's how it began. All these new ideas, you put them together and then you build something.
Yeah, you trade with people and then you have to deal with them because when you encounter people, you encounter different worldviews. They think differently about the world, and you have to make a decision about, do we agree with them on this or that other thing? If you have something in common, you have an idea that brings you together, and then you might find more in common or less in common. So trade is a very good way to get the interactions going. And then the more we know each other, we begin talking about real ideas. And the way ideas travel is that we borrow ideas from other people. And the story of philosophy is ideas might begin in one place. They might be shaped slightly differently in another place. They might be yet modified by a third place. And so if you are truly being honest about it, ideas are not the property of just one people. Ideas travel. And if you are telling the story of philosophy, we need to trace out, how did these ideas travel? Who borrowed from whom? And borrowing is not a bad thing. It's not a sense of superiority or inferiority. It is simply, we don't think of all the things that we need to by ourselves. Other people help us do that. Can we give them credit for what they have done? And philosophy has not been very good about giving credit to other places from which ideas have been borrowed from.
So philosophers need to travel more.
They should. Western philosophy needs to acknowledge the debts that it has to other traditions, and other traditions could learn a whole lot from Western philosophy. So there are traditions in philosophy, especially in Southeast Asia, where respect for age is a really big thing. And that then plays out in particular ways in social encounters. I think people in Southeast Asia could learn a lot from the ways in which Westerners engage with each other, in the way that Westerners could learn from the ways in which Southeast Asians engage with each other. So whenever we encounter people who are different, it gives us a window to see what are the possible ranges of human interaction. Are we doing everything that we can? Could we learn anything from these people we're now in contact with? And I think that is the exciting thing about philosophy. It allows you a window into better selves we could be.
Well, Socrates is known to do a lot of his philosophizing in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Which is, once again, commercial trade going on. And we talk about the marketplace of ideas where people can exchange ideas. But now, because of online retail, our market centers, our shopping centers, they're disappearing. So places where people would gather, now they don't even see each other. They just wait for the Amazon package to arrive. And so there's less of that sort of marketplace interaction than ever before.
So technology is changing the ways in which we interact. You're quite right about that. So social media, technology is changing the ways in which people come together. Now you're going to meet the people that agree with you much more online than you're going to meet them face-to-face.
Echo chambers.
More echo chambers. So you may find people who agree with you, and you may find people who disagree with you. These online communities are going to have to deal with. So how do we deal with people we might not otherwise have encountered? It has possibilities for both good and evil. We can find more people who agree with us, but it also can reinforce the ideas that we already have. And we can simply shut out people who don't agree with anything that we say.
Sam, it's been great talking with you. We're about out of time. But since we're recording this on January 2nd, at the beginning of 2020, do you have a good piece of advice or a resolution people can follow to open their minds for this next year?
Well, I don't know that I have any particular idea to pass on. But as always, it is a good thing to pay attention to your surroundings. Pay attention to what is happening. Ask yourself, what is it that is happening in front of me, and could I make it better? My sense is that most people are not paying attention because they're so drawn to social media or other interactions. They're so busy doing many things. Nobody is slowing down enough to look around them. So my one piece of advice would be, let's look around and try to make the place much better.
Okay. Make inside your own mind your own philosophical cafe.
Well, and talk with other people who might agree with you or might disagree, and do this respectfully.
Okay, very words of advice here from philosophy professor Sam Imbo, who's the chair of the department at Hamline University. Thanks for being with us.
Well,
again,
thank you very much for inviting me.
Nice to see you. I'm Steve LeBeau, and I'd also like to thank our producer, Dan Culhane, and to mention this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.